Okay, so I thought what I would do, which might be useful for this audience. There we go. Here's the organizer. yes, to give an overview of heavy fermion quantum criticality to begin with, and hopefully that will turn out to be brief. And then I'll, the main part is actually to talk about some recent work on the Fermi surfaces of the Kondo lattice, in particular inside the ordered phase, and how that could give some complementary views about the global phase diagram that in the last part I'll try to connect with some of the earlier works that I'll briefly summarize in the very first part. So, as Leon said, this talk is going to be about cold atoms, but not exactly. One thing which, in talking to Leon Bag, I thought at least the Fermi surface part, since that's something that's readily measurable in cold atom systems, perhaps that that there would be something that down the road would be of interest in this set of materials. All right, so let me just mention briefly the collaborators. The work on the Fermi surface inside the ordered phase is done with a graduate student, Seiji Yamamoto. And we continue to work on these things from this extended dynamical mean field perspective, although I would actually not really talk about that in this talk. But the recent work along that direction has been done in collaboration with Stefan Kirshner, who is a postdoc at Rice, and Jay Shinzu from Los Alamos, and some earlier collaborators listed over there, and a bunch of phenomenological aspects with the people listed in this panel. All right, so so why are we interested in these things? Part of it is that, well, quantum criticality is interesting in the global scheme of things, in correlated systems. And it happens that in heavy fermions, we actually do have these quantum critical points that have been explicitly observed experimentally. And there are not too many set of materials in which such a statement can be explicitly made. So so that makes it interesting. So this is one example, one of the very first ones of the heavy fermions in which one can observe the antifellow magnetic metal phase, and you see the T nail, and this is as a function of the gold doping in cerium copper 6, and so it's antifellow magnetic metal. T nail is, for all practical purposes, within the temperature range that we are interested in, or that can be probed in these systems, it seems to be going to zero continuously, and so that there is a quantum critical point separating antifellow magnetic metal phase and parallel magnetic metal phase. And the critical point seems to be around the critical point seems to be the setting in which a host of interesting things happen. So for instance, in this system, ytterbium, rhodium to silicon 2, the transition is tuned by magnetic field. And so there's, again, T nail versus magnetic field. And at the critical point, you can observe linear resistivity for a couple of decades, for about three decades of temperature. And linear resistivity in this type of systems is one characteristic of the deviation of the system deviating from the Fermi liquid behavior. While if you go into the phases, either the antifellow magnetic phase or the parallel magnetic phase at sufficiently low temperature, you get the T-square behavior that's indicated by this blue color panel, color scheme. So the phases, as this figure illustrates, seems to be reasonably conventional, and the critical quantum critical regime, there's this interesting non-Fermi liquid aspect. And here's another material, cerium, palladium to silicon 2, where similar things happen. The nail temperature comes down, as a function of pressure this time, and in the vicinity of the putative quantum critical point, there's some presumably unconventional superconducting phase that's popping up. So that's also an interesting phenomena that happens in the vicinity of a quantum critical point in these itonal systems that the other collective states can actually be observed. Yeah.
Is Tn in the ytterbium moving to silicon 2, is it determined by susceptibility or resistivity?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I mean, in here, there's actually inelastic neutron scattering measurement of the order parameter. In this material, Tn is primarily the combination of specific heat, resistivity, and some other things, not direct measurement of the order parameter.
So when it's not a susceptibility measurement.
No, uniform susceptibility measurement also gives indication for that, but not the finite Q susceptibility, right? Exactly. So that's one of the things that needs to be done. Here, I think at ambient pressure, there is neutron scattering that has been done. So some ordering phenomena is understood better in some of these materials than others. So, thanks to Bill Gates. All right. So just to set this problem up, obviously, if we see a magnetic quantum critical point, the first thing to think about this problem is just to think about what the order parameter is, and integrate everything else out and construct a theory based on fluctuations of the order parameter. And so the only distinction here from classical critical point is that the fluctuation of the order parameter in both space and time. So that was the first thing that was done by Hertz and others in this particular context. And that leads to a Phi-4 theory in these spatial dimensions, and Z dynamic exponent characterizes the fluctuations in the temporal dimension. And T plus Z typically turns out to be either larger than or equal to 4. So the quantum critical point in this itinerant systems is supposed to be exceedingly simple. It's a Gaussian fixed point. You would expect to see a lot of mean field exponent. And in the scaling phenomena, because it's a Gaussian fixed point, things like damping has to be controlled by some irrelevant coupling. So as it turned out, it would lead to the violation of omega over T scaling. And so historically, the first pretty direct indication for the breakdown of this quantum to classical mapping, the Phi-4 theory of the order parameters, was the inelastic neutron scattering. So this is pretty, by now, pretty old data. So I'll just mention that things like omega over T scaling, which was not supposed to be showing up at a quantum critical point like this, was observed for about 4 decades of the ratio of omega over T. There's a fractional exponent as supposed to be the mean field exponent, which would be 1 here. And there's some pretty more exotic feature that this exponent seems to, in some particular way of looking at it, seems to be showing up not only at the anti-fellow magnetic wave vector, but at other wave vectors as well. Now, one can, on very general grounds, one can imagine various ways that this quantum to classical mapping can break down. The assumption there is that, well, you just choose the order parameter fluctuations as characterized in the critical mode, and everything else is bystanders. You integrate them all out, but perhaps that the theory that you construct for some of the systems may not be well defined, and surely you can imagine the breakdown of this description. And
are all the examples magnetic, or
All the examples in which things are unusual?
Yeah.
Well, there are not too many non-magnetic quantum critical points that there have been.
There are some ferroelectrics you can.
Yeah, that's insulating.
And also, I guess there's even a low TC superconductor in a magnetic field.
Yeah.
Zero temperature. Is that interesting?
Yeah, I think there are other things which come in and come into complicated. It's not being as systematically studied experimentally. The vortex it's primarily the magnetic things which have been studied more systematically, unfortunately.
So all of these are magnetic metal to paramagnetic metal.
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, the insulating ones, for instance, the holmium doped, this transverse field Ising model, it looks like a mean field exponent is observed, but even there, dynamics actually has not been really systematically studied. Right. I think it's not entirely excellent because these metals, you have more probes, and that's.
But you only mentioned F-electro materials, though.
Yeah, and there are more F electron material examples than non-F electron material examples, presumably because the energy scales here are smaller and it's easier to tune around the states to actually reach the quantum critical point.
But there are some deep band examples, aren't there, where you have weak magnets which you can tune by pressure?
Yes. So for instance, some of these ferromagnetic or almost ferromagnetic ones were supposed to be good examples, but somehow the first order nature has come into play and complicates things. Well, not necessarily complicates. It seems to be revealing some other interesting things, like a phase of non-ferromagnetic liquid and so on and so forth. There are some. I think that just a couple of days ago on the continent map, there's a paper from Takagi's group on some nickel sulfur selenide system. And so there, actually, it's a very interesting system because the energy scale is much higher. You have a chance of doing a lot of other measurements. But ironically, the F electron materials, you would think they are the more complicated ones. They are the ones which are allowing us to experimentally study them in this particular context. I should also, maybe it's interesting because of the nature of program, that cold atom realization of these things apparently has been made in not the ultra cold atoms in the context of this program, but in helium-3 on graphite. Apparently, the first layer of helium-3 on graphite is actually having helium-3 localized, and the second layer of the helium-3 is apparently eternant. So that. All the indication from phenomenology seems to be that that's a realization of the atomic heavy fermion type of system that can be tuned around through some what looks like a translation from thermodynamic indications. All right, so to think about this problem historically was to just go back to the Candolades description where you have the F electrons, which are localized, so they form essentially a magnetic component, and you have conduction electrons and a candle interaction between the two. At every lattice site, for people who are not necessarily initiated in these things, you have the spin, which is F electrons and the conduction electrons, and spins can talk to each other through the exchange interactions, and conduction electrons can move around. And there's kind of exchange interaction between the two species. And there was a lot of historical development. The description of the heavy Fermi liquid, the paramagnetic metal phase, and the notion such as large Fermi surface came along historically. And I'll actually come back to this issue later part of the talk. But as far as the quantum critical point is concerned, some general considerations and some microscopic work based on this extended dynamical mean field formulation, which captures some of the various phases in its particular way, led to this notion that that you can have this scale that characterizes the Kondo screening, which is finite, deep in the paramagnetic phase. But when the system approaches the magnetic quantum critical point, the scale would crash down to zero. So this destruction of Kondo screening provides an additional piece of critical fluctuations, and that can coexist with the critical magnetic fluctuations, and that. Changes the underlying critical theory. It's no longer just 5-4 theory, and it doesn't have to be mean field. And so some sequence of calculations, some analytical, some numerical, have led to the statement that indeed, when the Kondo screening is critical, the magnetic dynamics do have this anomalous exponent and omega over T scaling. So that was at least in terms of initial motivation from the magnetic dynamics, this was providing, this has been providing a way of thinking about the origin.
Yeah. An experimental manifestation of E star law.
Yeah, I'll come to that. If you, two slides down, I'll just mention that. Yeah. So at this point, it's just I'm just making a theoretical statement that there's the if some effective Kondo scale is crashing down to zero. So it's an energetic statement, and we'll see how it's measurable. Now, one consequence of this E local star coming to zero is that the heavy firm liquid state, which is the ground state on the parallel magnet side, the physics of the Kondo resonances induced by the Kondo screening, that would go away as you go through the quantum critical point. So the Fermi surface would have a jump in the sense that I will spend more time. Yeah.
Do you need other kind of tuning other than delta to be able to get this E local getting to zero right at quantum?
Yeah, so if you do the particular microscopic calculation based on extended dynamical mean field theory, this thing happens when the magnetic fluctuations are two-dimensional. And if you have three-dimensional magnetic fluctuation, the scale is actually finite at the critical point.
Electrons always live in three dimensions?
Electrons doesn't really matter that much. Yeah. So the transport and anisotropy doesn't play a particular important role in this consideration.
So the two-dimensionality is in the spins?
Yeah, in the spatial dependence of the magnetic spin fluctuations.
And in the experiments that you noted, was that the case?
Well, that was actually part of initial motivation. The cerium copper cis gold, if you look at the Q scans, two scans look normal, and the third scan looks rather flat. And now, how flat that's flat, that's obviously up to debate, but it's much considerably flatter in one direction than the other two directions.
That somehow happens in this. It's not in the crystal structure or anything.
No. Yeah, so that's part of the mystery is why that happens, whether it's due to more collective reasons or other reasons that's not really understood. All right. So
that simple way to understand why in two dimensions this happens at precisely the same point?
Well, I only have the answer based on this particular microscopic extended dynamical mean field scheme, and that is that the reason this scale is coming down is because the local moments are feeling the effect of the collective magnetic fluctuations. These collective magnetic fluctuations act as dissipation for the local moment. That's what this formalism captures. And so the critical point is where the collective fluctuation is the softest, so that they can do the maximum damage to the Kondo screening effect. Now the question is whether the damage is enough to actually kill it entirely. And we think this, so obviously reduced dimensionality enhances the effect of dissipation because the phase space is enhanced. And 2D happens to be big enough phase space that you can see by looking at local susceptibility, which actually has to be logarithmically divergent if the eta, the spatial fluctuation eta, is equal to zero. And so that's how this works out. Well, 3D, that's not there's not enough phase space for the dissipation to actually kill the Kondo screening. Okay. All right. So the necessary consequence of the statement which has been made so far is that in the process of understanding the magnetic dynamics making this E local star goes to zero, at a critical point, the electronic properties have to change pretty drastically, going from a large Fermi surface on the parallel magnetic side with a volume of 1 plus x, where 1 counts the local moments and x counts the number of conduction electrons, to the anti-ferromagnetic side, where it only counts the x conduction electrons. So the remainder of the talk is really to look at this Fermi surface first on the ordered side, because this really is the property of the phase, and we can look at the phase from a different anchoring point, and see whether that can be understood not in terms of like energetics or collection collapse of an energy scale as is coming out for instance in this extended dynamical mean field scheme, but more looking at the k-space in some more detail. And then that piece of information can be tied up with what we traditionally we thought we understood about how the large Fermi surface comes about on the ferromagnetic metal side.
Shouldn't you also change the Brillouin zone once you magnetically order?
Yeah, it's a part of the issue that I'll describe in some detail.
Large and small.
Yeah, at this moment, let's take it as a heuristic, and I'll come back to define it more carefully. Okay. But before I do that, let me just make one slide just to summarize some of the experiments that have taken place over the recent past few years that are pertinent to this issue of whether there is a Fermi surface jump in the across the magnetic transition, magnetic quantum transition, and the issue of multiple energy scales. So there are two pieces of experiments which provide one more indirect than the other some evidence for the jump of the Fermi surface, even though we are talking about the second order quantum magnetic transition. One is that the Hall coefficient that you can measure across you can define a temperature measurement as a function of the control parameter. And in the ytterbium rhodium 2 silicon 2, a rapid crossover is observed at a finite temperature, and the width of the crossover by extrapolation over a temperature range of about 1.5 a decade, it's extrapolating to zero in a zero temperature limit. So that implies that there is a jump of the Hall coefficient at a zero temperature, and the location of the jump, again by extrapolation, is at the quantum critical point. And since Hall coefficient, the discussion here is about the Fermi liquid state of the two sides, the phases for all practical purposes are pretty conventional. One could connect the Hall coefficient change with the change of the underlying Fermi surface. So the jump indirectly would suggest that indeed the Fermi surface is jumping across this second order magnetic transition. There's a more recent and a more direct indication from the Hassmann alpha measurements, which in principle is a very direct measurement of the Fermi surface, but the reason it hasn't been done as widely as in all these materials is because doing the Hassmann alpha requires a large magnetic field, and magnetic field of 10 tesla or so, and that's a pretty big perturbation to these kind of systems where the scale itself is about 20 kelvin or even 10 kelvin. But in this material, cerium, rhodium, indium 5, there's indication that 10 tesla magnetic field is precisely what you need to actually kill some of the phases that exist in zero field, like superconductivity. And at a 10 tesla around 10 tesla magnetic field as a function of pressure, the transition is actually from the magnetic order state to non-magnetic state, both are metallic. So that's a fortuitous situation where the Hassmann alpha is actually pretty good to look at in some detail how the Fermi surface is evolving across the magnetic transition. And the data which is in this reference from Anuki's group in Japan, in Osaka, is that the Fermi surface, the oscillation frequencies actually do switch around the transition pressure, and in such a way that the mass is actually with some smeared divergence when you approach a transition. So that's at least to me is a pretty striking and a pretty direct indication about a sharp change of the Fermi surface across a magnetic transition.
How many bands are crossing the Fermi level?
A lot.
Pardon?
A lot.
So then how many bands does the Gaussmann arguments can see?
They see, I think on one side they see something like 5, 6, 7, and the other side 3 or so. But the point is that the oscillation frequencies are essentially essentially flat on one side of phased transition, and it's essentially flat in a region that's probed on the other side, but the two are disjoint.
I guess the question is whether the Fermi surface that's involved in the contour screening is jumping, or some other Fermi surface is jumping.
I mean the mass is pretty heavy. The mass of the some of the bands that's observed is pretty heavy, so you have reasonable confidence that the heavy guys are actually participating in the switching. And they do things like compiling with the band structure calculations, assuming F electrons are localized, and separately band structure calculations, assuming F electrons are itinerant, and you can make a comparison. And there is some identification that you can make between the observed frequencies and the calculated ones. So I think it looks reasonable, at least to me.
Are there any bits of the Fermi surface missing? Because I know sometimes these heavy fermion systems don't see all of it.
I'm sure there are. I mean, one's 7 and the other is 3, for instance. So, yeah. But it's good to see something, right? I mean,
Is that compound generic? I mean, you said there were special reasons why you could actually do the Hausmann algorithm, but if you look at all the quantum critical aspects, would you believe it might be the same as the other ones?
As I said, the Hausmann algorithm is the applied field is doing a pretty big perturbation to the material. So genetically, you only observe the phases. The anti-ferromagnet phase has doing, the paramagnetic metal phase has doing. You can't really zoom in to the vicinity of quantum critical point. And ironically, these what I call small Fermi surface, and I'll define more carefully, is typically observed when you do the Hausmann alpha inside the anti-ferromagnetic heavy fermion metals. And the large Fermi surface is typically observed in the paramagnetic phases. Now, such data actually have existed for a while. And so it's kind of ironic that thinking about these small Fermi surfaces inside the other side, on the theoretical side, is considered to be somewhat exotic. Partly because I think the heavy fermion, Fermi liquid description became so successful. People work very hard for that. And so it's very natural to think that the magnetic ordered phase is actually typically the SDW phase of that large Fermi surface paramagnetic metal. But the direct Fermi surface measurements have always been that it's more often than not that you see small Fermi surface on the magnetic side. All right, the data is, I just don't want to get too much of a long discussion in this talk, but I just mentioned this. And then the multiple energy scale measurement, and that connects to with what Mohit asked, how can you see this e-local star, is that in this paper, there's a measurement of set of thermodynamic quantities and a transport quantity. Again, the same thing, you do the isothermal scan and identify where there's some feature, and that as a function of control parameter. So that defines the value of a control parameter at which there is some feature. Let's see which side is brighter. It's probably equally. So this is then ytterbium, rhodium, to silicon, to this is T nail, and this is you do the isothermal scan and identify some feature in some of these thermodynamic quantities, and so it turns out that there are various properties you can measure that defines one scale, and then there's various properties you can measure that defines a separate scale. And
what is the feature?
So I can just briefly describe. So across this one, for instance, both the magnetization the magnetostriction, which is the volume change in response to the magnetic field. This control parameter is actually a magnetic field. In a usual ferromolecule, it should be linear, and it is at a low field. But then at some place, it bends to another slope. Okay, and so the feature is a kink in this plot. For both of these, they more or less can scale on top of each other. And that couples with, for instance, rho xy is doing similar things like that. So now you can identify where by some criteria, where the crossover is centered around, and what's the width of that crossover is. And so the width of the crossover is becoming smaller and smaller and extrapolates to zero. So that defines this scale. And since the width is going to zero, the statement is that the physical quantity which are being looked at, which is, for instance, the differentiation of these quantities with respect to magnetic field, actually has an extrapolated jump in the zero temperature limit, while across this scale, everything does what scaling is supposed to be, ordinary scaling behavior. These two scales are distinct, and the interpretation is that this scale would be just something like C to minus Z, and this is something else. And given that the Hall coefficient changing pretty rapidly, why not interpreting that as the E local star? So that's as direct a check as exists as of now. All right. So that concludes my overview part. Is there any other questions? All right, so let me move on to the Kondo effect in the presence of the anti-ferromagnetic order in the Kondo lattice. So back to the Kondo lattice model, you have the exchange interaction among local moments, you have the conduction electrons, and the Kondo coupling. The limit that we've decided to look at is the limit where the Kondo coupling is much smaller than the exchange interaction among the F spins, and much smaller than the bandwidth. Okay. And this is a limit where when you can expand around the J Kondo equal to zero, where the two components are decoupled, and we arrange the local moment part to be in the anti-ferromagnetic ordered phase, and the conduction electron part is conduction electrons.
So, Simeon, yeah. Why do you need to put in the exchange coupling by hand? Won't it be generated?
The generated one I just lump into the one that I just want to have a global parameter space so I can look at the various corners of a phase diagram.
I mean, if you were to really solve the theory, you would be overcounting that because you put it in by hand, it's going to be generated also.
Yeah, so that just got twisted the phase diagram somewhat. The presumably important parameters are the dimensionless Kondo coupling and dimensionless effective exchange interaction. That's the spirit of what's being done.
Just looking at a generalized phase diagram.
Yeah. I mean, I think for the purpose of what kind of phases there exist in this, and I don't see any. It should be okay. Now, so we can do the since the Kondo coupling equals zero limit, we can just map the local moment part into the quantum nonlinear sigma model where G is the coupling constant, the Berry phase is presumably unimportant. Inside ordered phase, and the conduction, you can go through the usual mapping, and conduction electrons will have some self-interaction that's generated. What's slightly non-trivial is the way the nonlinear sigma model fields are coupled to the conduction electron spin. So let me explain that in some more detail. It's n cross dn over d tau coupled to the spins of the conduction electrons. So basically, if you look at the low-lying excitations of inside for the anti-ferromagnetic component of the F spins, of the coherent spin waves and of these incoherent excitations, and it's gapless around Q equals zero as well. And the conduction electron part, I want to be able to define what is small Fermi surface and what is large Fermi surface more nicely. So let me arrange the conduction electron Fermi surface itself to be not intersecting the magnetic zone boundary. So that actually relates to part of the question that you asked, because that makes the zone folding to be easier to discuss. All right. So now we just couple these two components together. And so in the usual Kondo problem, everywhere in Q of the local moment phase space, you would couple to the conduction electrons. But since we are inside anti-ferromagnetic phase, there are only two regions which have gapless excitation. So that simplifies the problem considerably. And in this case, when I make the arrangement that the conduction electron Fermi surface is actually not touching the magnetic zone boundary, the linear coupling, the coupling of the spin waves sitting at a Q close to the ordering wave vector would not have the phase space to connect two points of the Fermi surface. So that linear coupling actually goes away. And what's left is basically the Q, the uniform component that's coupled to the conduction electron. That certainly can connect two points of the Fermi surface. And so from the conduction electron point of view, this is a purely forward scattering. And we know in various contexts that if it's forward scattering for conduction electrons, things simplify considerably. And that statement applies to this particular issue as well. Yeah.
Are you starting from the antiferromagnetic order side and then try to move towards the quantum field?
Right now, I'm deep in the antiferromagnetic order of the phase. I haven't asked the question what would happen if I move towards the transition.
And you started with a small Fermi surface?
I start.
Because the picture seemed to suggest that.
Well, small and large in the context of a Kondo lattice really refers to whether the local moment, the F electrons participate in that. So the size here doesn't really matter. The only thing that I've arranged is that the conduction electron Fermi surface does not intersect the antiferromagnetic zone boundary.
Okay.
That simplifies analysis considerably. So I don't want to call it a small Fermi surface.
Is the Q here commensurate with pi pi or?
Yeah, let's just make life simpler. Let's make it commensurate. The incommensurate has other complications.
Why is the location as the gamma point not as pi pi?
No, I'm starting from conduction electrons, right? And the conduction electron Fermi surface could be complicated, but I've chosen the conduction electron part of the Fermi surface of a conduction electron part to be centered on zone center for no lack of generality. But the important point is that it's only the M which is coupled to the conduction electrons, and that forward scattering nature simplifies the problem considerably. So now we can because only forward scattering is important, one can actually do this combined fermionic and bosonic RG. One can actually carry through the phase space for analysis for both of them. So the fermions live in the vicinity of Fermi surface, and the N modes live near Q equals zero. And so this one can use the counting. Well, you can count the dimension according to the fermionic RG for the electrons, and you can count the dimension of this N cross the N of the tau field. That's the phi here for the nonlinear single model, and the K for the conduction electrons, since they live in the vicinity of Fermi surface, only one direction scales. And so taking all these things together, one can establish that at the tree level, this effective Kondo coupling is marginal. Okay. All right. So one can go beyond the tree level and go to one loop. And at one loop, the problem simplifies because the nonlinear single model itself, the G is flowing to zero. And it's because of the forward scattering, so the self-interactions of the fermions That doesn't generate any loop correction to the beta function. That's known to Shankar. The question here is whether the conduction electrons coupled to these n's are written in terms of these pi fields, whether that generates any loop correction or not. And then you can one can address that question by going through phase-based considerations. Again, the fermions live in the vicinity of Fermi surface, so you're integrating out a shell in one outside the Fermi surface, one inside the Fermi surface. That's the phase space of the fermion that you're integrating out, and this is the phase space of the pi fields that you are integrating out, and the region that it can contribute turns out to be d lambda to 3/2. So again, there's no one loop correction to the beta function. So at the one loop level, it stays marginal. And then going to infinite loops, one can use again the fermionic RG type of argument for the usual Fermi liquid theory. It can introduce the patches around the Fermi surface and doing something like a 1 over n lambda expansion. And that leads to the conclusion that to infinite loops, this Kondo coupling is marginal. Okay. And because it is marginal, the reason we have a large Fermi surface, and again, that's, I'll come back to the paramagnetic side. The reason we have large Fermi surface in the heavy fermion paramagnetic Fermi liquid side is because of the strong coupling fixed point. The Kondo coupling is flowing towards strong coupling, so you have the singular deformation, and the singular deformation leads to, in the ground state, leads to the Kondo resonances in the excitation spectrum, and that's how the Fermi's the local moments participate in the count of the conduction electrons. Here, it's exactly marginal, so there's no reason for these local moments to participate in the electron count. And you can...
This picture eventually should break down, right? Yeah. The Kondo coupling is big
because... I'm saying that the Kondo coupling is small.
Because, right? You know, the nonlinear single model, the G equals to 1 theory.
Yeah.
It's a relativistic theory. But, you know, the coupling within this sigma model and the conduction electron is sufficiently big. And I can imagine that whatever the spectrum of the magnetic fluctuation should eventually change. Right?
Yeah.
There are all these gap phase fluctuations.
So the statement is that when the Kondo coupling becomes of order of the exchange interaction of the anti-ferromagnet, presumably, then you start to see that these gap excitations and presumably that. So I'll actually.
Modify the sigma model. This basically.
But it will also affects the coupling. You know, you have to take into account these gap excitations and I will give some heuristic argument towards the end about what happens when the Kondo coupling increases and how do you, what kind of instability can happen and how does that merge with the consideration from the other side. Okay, but for now, I'm asking the question whether the small Fermi surface anti-ferromagnetic phase is stable phase or not. So the exact marginal nature implies that it is, and you can verify that by doing some large n limit of this effective model and calculate the conduction electron propagators explicitly, and you see that there's no pole in the self-energy of conduction electrons, and therefore the Fermi surface stays small. Yeah.
This calculation of RG, why the result is so different from the single coupling impurities?
Yeah, the difference is, as I alluded to earlier, in the single impurity, all the Q couples. Here, only at the end of the day, only forward scattering couples. So that drastically changed the nature of this coupling.
Young Beck, I wasn't sure if I understood your question. Were you asking about how damping fluctuations appears in this
exactly
formulation?
Some lambda damping, whatever, eventually should appear.
I think it's an order of limits question, right? Because he's always fixing K far from the, you know, some distance from the Fermi surface.
So you never
then
get K, that?
Then you'd look at low omega and K for the,
yes, sir,
the spin fluctuation, right? The lambda damping, you need to get arbitrarily close to the Fermi surface.
That's true, yeah. So I see. So you never get the worries away from that point, yeah?
The other things that happen when the Kano coupling becomes order of the exchange interaction. This part, it's surprising that this has not been done before, to my knowledge. But at least this analysis establishes the stability of the anti-ferromagnet small Fermi surface phase. So I hope
was that ever in doubt?
I think there are probably two levels of answer to that question.
Okay.
To some, probably not. I think the widespread view is that the ordered phase is a SDW phase of a paramagnetic large Fermi surface phase. So in that sense, it's not.
From that conventional point of view, you would start in the paramagnet, generate an
SDW instability.
Nest out, sort of gap out parts of the Fermi surface.
That's correct.
But other pieces remain.
Yeah.
And what do those pieces look like?
I'll show a plot, but it's a distinctive phase in certain part of phase diagram. You can specify how they are different shape.
It looks quite different, is what you were saying.
Right.
That's what you want to distinguish? I thought you were going to maybe I missed the point today, but you're going to some pains to demonstrate that if you have a ordered anti-ferromagnet weakly coupled to a Fermi liquid with a wave vector that doesn't nest, that that's a stable state. That's what's demonstrated now, and that, I don't find that surprising.
Well, at a certain level, it's not, because you can imagine integrating out the spin waves and construct some effective interactions between electrons, although both are gapless, so the interaction may have some retardation and other things that could affect whether one can really think of that as Landau parameters. But I think at the end of the day, this analysis shows that way of thinking is essentially correct, that you have exact marginal nature of the effective Kano coupling establishes that, for as far as the fermions are concerned, what this interaction is doing is generate a Landau parameter. But this issue has not been explicitly discussed in the past, as far as I know, theoretically. It's nice.
But that's sort of a side point for you. It's more the main point I want to take is to contrast this state with the SDWs.
Yeah. I'll come to that. Mm-hmm. But we. This part of the NASA, I think it's nice to know that this phase does exist from general considerations. All right. Now, to put the existence of this phase with our standard understanding of the large Fermi surface phase together, let me just sketch the phase diagram that I want to look at. So this is the Kando coupling axis. And you can draw a generic axis that represents the local moment, the magnetism, and why not introducing some dimensionless parameters that allow you to get different parts of the magnetism for the F component. All right. So what I've just described says that when the local moment part is anti-ferromagnetic, and for small Kando coupling, this anti-ferromagnet phase with small Fermi surface is a stable phase. So that phase does exist. And heuristically, for people who don't look at these things extensively, we can think of this local moment trying to form a singlet with the conduction electrons, but don't quite manage. And so at the end of the day, local moments have no business in the electron fluid. If you are here, when the Kando coupling is the largest scale in the problem, it's believed that this problem, that we have a large Fermi surface. And so the notion is that in a ground state, there's a singlet that's formed between the local moments and the conduction electrons, and that that singlet formation in the ground state leads to the in the excitations the Fermionic excitation that's large Fermi surface. So there's a very rather simple way of seeing that, which is that consider this limit where the Kondo coupling is even much larger than the bandwidth. You're not going to get large mass out in this limit, but you're going to get the conduction electron, the electron Fermi surface count correctly. So here, basically, at every site I have one local moment, and some of sites I have conduction electrons because I'm in a, this incommensurate situation. And since the Kondo coupling is the largest scale in the problem, whenever we're looking at sites where there's both a conduction electron and local moment, they form a tightly bound singlet, and all the other states are high energy states, which you can just remove from the spectrum or do perturbations, generate some effective interactions for the low energy part of the states. All right. So now, on the other hand, you have these 1 minus x. So x is the number of electron per site. So you have 1 minus x times n site of the sites that the local moment is standing alone. There's not a conduction electron that accompanies it. And so these sites, I can use, I don't have a tight singlet, but I can project them into this singular basis. So the way you to do that is to just to start from the singlet and remove a conduction electron of opposite spin, and you end up with the local moment, okay? And then you have the other other parts of the, which we don't care. So within, from using the singlet as the vacuum, basically you're creating a hole. A long moment is equivalent to creating a hole, and this hole actually have infinite repulsion among themselves because you cannot. You can only create one hole. You can only remove one electron starting from a singlet. So that's the infinite U self-interaction, outside interaction among each of these holes. So you start from this Kondo lattice problem in this particular limit, Kondo coupling being the largest scale in the problem. What you end up is a problem of 1 minus x holes with infinite repulsion among themselves. And now, so far, the argument is exact. But the part which is not exact, and that I think makes the existence of large Fermi surface in some sense is not as rigorously proved, is that you have to make two assumptions from this point on. One is that indeed, by having this singular formation and having these holes, instead, these holes, which not only have infinite repulsion, but they also have the kinetic energy of the original conduction electrons because singlet can move around with the same hopping parameter of the conduction electrons. And
is it not reduced by 1 over root 2 or something?
It's, I think it works out to be not reduced because, yes, this square root 2. Yeah, I mean pictorially it's pretty obvious, right? I can move.
Think the spin in the singlet, the underlying spin is half the time the wrong way around or something. So.
Yeah. So the effects, the wave function certainly have a square root two.
Hopping into a triplet state or something like that.
No, I'm not going out of sector. I just move the singlet to the right.
Okay,
no, with
I
the same,
that
yeah,
picture, but
right.
I think doesn't that imply reduction in the bandwidth?
Yeah, one can work. I think it does not, but yeah. There's a minus sign, right? That, because it's a hole. But so the point is that if I assume that this kinetic motion actually makes the system to be parallel magnetic, which for other reasons we know it is, and for other microscopic reasons. And second is that it's parallel magnetic, and let's assume it's a Fermi liquid, in which case we can apply the Luttinger's theorem, even though there's infinite repulsion. Then we end up with a Fermi surface that counts 1 minus x holes. And 1 minus x holes is equivalent to 1 plus x electrons. So that's the route that connects the singlet in the ground state to the large Fermi surface in the electron excitation spectrum. So if we have a parallel magnetic large phase and antiphellum and a small phase, you
so
can.
Can I just
yeah, sure.
ask a question about your last slide? Mm-hmm. I mean, in a way, thinking the other way around about the singlets moving around in a spin background due to the unpaired moments.
Yeah.
I mean, that sounds a bit like ITC, doesn't it? With the holes moving around in a Hubbard model with a set of spins and the issue about how the spin degeneracy is lifted by the hole motion in that case, which would be the singlet motion in this case.
Yeah.
So is there an issue about what the magnetic ground state is?
Well,
of this assembly of your holes with spin.
When X, for instance, when X is either close to zero or close to one.
Well, something like
it's a Nagaoka problem,
but
yeah.
Once the concentration is finite,
yeah.
That's not well understood.
No, so I don't think we know when ferromagnetism, whether there's a finite region of ferromagnetism or something else. And also, obviously, you know, if to really analyze a phase diagram, you have to get a T square over J terms and all these things into the picture. So the magnetic phase diagram could be complicated. It doesn't have to be parallel magnet. That's I think I said it very carefully. That,
okay, yeah,
right.
But in nature it is.
Well, in nature it is, and in some large Young limit it is. Yeah, and that's what people work very hard to get the heavy fermion, large fermion surface state for you know some large chunk of history. So we have the parallel magnetic large phase and antiphellum small phase. So in principle, one can have one stage of a transition or two stages of a transition. And in a two stage of a transition, this phase is what traditionally thought as the magnetic phase of these kind of lattice system, which is the spin density wave instability of this large Fermi surface. So in this particular construction, this is the antiphellum spin density wave gap, and you have these pockets that are formed from the folding of the magnetic zone. The volume of this is actually the same as the volume of that, but if there is a multi-critical point, one can the order parameter is small, so this one can see the topology of these two phases to be distinct, and that's a Lipschitz transition that would distinguish between these, sharply distinguish these two phases.
Is this going to be a Boussard transition?
The usual Lipschitz transition without structural things can be second order, right? And the other complications that structural coupling and so on and so forth, that turns into the first order.
Yeah.
Well, now just think of this as tuning the magnetic part. So the larger G, the quantum fluctuations about among the in the local moment component.
It's not W, it's not IRKKY, it's some new variable.
Think about the next nearest neighbor coupling divided by nearest neighbor coupling in the magnetic component, for instance.
One over
S. So now, I think this the other issue which has brought up in was yeah, sure.
We just heard that you said 15 minutes ago or so how complicated the Fermi surfaces actually are.
Yeah.
All
right.
Is it clear that such a cartoon picture of the changes in these Fermi surfaces is sensible?
Well, so let's even ask the question here at this corner, right?
If you're asking about the transition across your beige line.
Yeah, right. I think it's easiest to discuss in the vicinity of this corner, where the order parameters are all very small, okay? And in that case, because if I cross this boundary, I immediately go from this phase to a large Fermi surface phase, right? I can switch off the order parameter and get back to a large Fermi surface. And if I cross this, you know, with a very small change in the order parameter, it does not go back to the large Fermi surface. So I would make a statement that very generally across this, if you are doing a crossing here, the Fermi surface should be, the topology should be distinct. Now, when the order parameter is not small, you know, some of these pockets can go away a lot of things can be happening inside the order phase. And on general grounds, I'm not sure the distinction can be made very very precise.
But in nature, you never see multiple antiferromagnetic phases. Is that correct?
Well, that's not. This issue hasn't really been very.
People have done specific events. They haven't seen other at least haven't seen evidence for lots of transitions, multiple phases.
There are. I mean, like even ytterbium rhodium to silicon to there's two stages of magnetic transitions, and that has not been really. Some of these could be just the magnetic component itself is undergoing a change.
But the evidence is from transport?
Yeah, there, unfortunately. Yeah. There's some measurement in cerium indium-3 as a function of magnetic field. They can follow the Hausmann alpha, and there's some changes in the Fermi surface that indicates. So I think this issue has not really been very carefully looked at. I was going to comment on one thing, which was what Jon Back was saying about what can happen when a condo coupling becomes large compared to the you start from here and increase this way, and the point is that at some point you can't just couple a nonlinear signal model with the conduction electrons. These gap excitations need to be taken into account, and presumably. When J condo becomes sufficiently large than the gap, then some of this singular deformation physics would come back in, and that presumably leads to a magnetic. It's possible it leads to a magnetic phase that's the same as the SDW phase of the paramagnetic phase. That's one way for increasing the condo coupling can lead to, and. Connected with the consideration from the other side. All right. Now, so if I have this type 2 transition, that's the magnetism Fermi surface is adiabatic, smoothly connected from the two sides, and presumably we're back to the Hertz type of quantum critical point. Well, if I have a direct transition from the paramagnet large phase to the antiferromagnet small phase, and if it is second order, then the only way for it to second order is the quasi-particle residue for both the large Fermi surface and the small Fermi surface to have to go to zero as you approach the transition. And the quasi-particle residue going to zero would, in general, be, so that necessarily implies that the critical point is a non-Fermi liquid, and at the same time, typically, that leads to the mass that's divergent when you approach the transition, the actual mass to be divergent when you approach the transition from both sides. So that connects the z goes to zero. That also connects to what I said earlier about the energy scale.
And it's in the two phases, and you're saying this is what should happen at the transition.
Yeah.
Rather than understanding why these two coincidences happen.
The analysis that I'm describing in detail refers to only this corner here, and that couples with what we know about that corner. The detailed analysis of a transition, I think this method that I described to you is pretty hard to carry through. And then I go back to what we've been doing in terms of extended dynamical mean field theory that covers these phases in somewhat rudimentary fashion, because you only treats the energy scales and so on and so forth. But from that approach, at least I can approach the transition and make a statement when type 1 transition can happen and when type 2 transition happens. So that's the part that I'm trying to connect with what I've just done in terms of the Fermi surfaces with the chain of work that has been done in terms of energetics and other things. So that's pretty much it. I'll just put a summary here. And thanks.
Okay, then this story is quite specific to antiferromagnetic model, if I have a ferromagnetic model.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult to avoid, right? Because you are sort of, in some sense, you're sort of getting out pi.
Yeah.
Coupled, you know.
So I can't do that. I can't do that trick any longer. That's correct. Yeah. So I cannot arrange the perhaps. Yeah, I cannot arrange the conduction electron Fermi surface to be not touching the magnetosphere boundary because that's Q equals zero. Yeah. So then you have to incorporate the Zeeman splitting of the conduction electrons induced by the Kondo coupling with the underlying ferromagnetic order of the spins explicitly. That's one thing that changed if you go from anti-ferromagnetic to the ferromagnetic case. And the second thing is that in the anti-ferromagnet, the linear signal model, the time dependence you've already done by treating part of the Berry phase. But in the ferromagnetic case, the time dependence actually is explicitly given by the Berry phase term. So you have to include the Berry phase term in the analysis explicitly. So we have some partial result along that direction. It turns out that the two things combined actually make the problem still manageable because the Zeeman splitting makes the transverse coupling to be, as far as electrons are concerned, to have a gap, right?
Then you only have a Kondo coupling smaller than the Zeeman energy or something?
Well, they are both induced by the Kondo coupling, right? So there's a question of how big the magnetic order parameter is. Yes. So those things, yeah, exactly. It's still a doable problem. And it's actually turned out to be experimentally relevant as well because there have been the Hassmann alpha measurement of Fermi surface in ferromagnetic Kondo lattices.
Sorry, I missed the beginning part. So I just want to ask, just find out whether my what this problem is true. So the phenomena you say, does it require some amount of RKKY interactions or
I do.
In a pure Kondo model, that you think by normalization you get some RKKY, and you can still get that.
Yeah.
If that is the case, then where would this happen in the original Kondo lattice?
Yeah, so here I have three parameters, the RKKY coupling. I call it RKKY, but let's call it, give a different name, the Heisenberg coupling between the moments. Okay. And then the Kondo coupling and the bandwidth. So I'm allowing these three to be independent parameters, right? As you said, in real Kondo lattice, a Kondo coupling will generate a contribution to second order of J Kondo square over W, okay? And so it depends on where you are. The exponential of this, the effective Kondo scale, is either smaller than this or larger than this. That's the usual Dalnyak criteria of the competition between Kondo and the RKKY. Now, in this analysis, I can do a second order and just add to the original term. And that's my J-H prime. So I'm constructing, I'm considering the problem in a slightly enlarged phase space where this is one parameter, that's another parameter, and ask how many distinctive phases that can in principle exist and what kind of transitions can take place. So I don't think it's going to change a whole lot of the general phase diagram. Whether you explicitly include it or not. In real material, it's going to be cut in this two-dimensional parameter phase space anyway.
Okay.